You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to our forum on the future of unlicensed spectrum. So we've set up a Twitter feed at hashtag TechCTI. That's TechCTI. So any of you who wish to pose comments or ask questions are welcome to do so. So our topic today is wireless spectrum and how it powers mobile technology. We see this through devices such as baby monitors, garage door openers, and a wide range of other Wi-Fi networks that connect people and businesses. Unlicensed spectrum is a vital part of the mix that enables many of the innovations that all of us use every day. But unlicensed spectrum is a scarce resource, and we need public policy decisions that provide sufficient spectrum for consumers and businesses. We face dramatic increases in mobile usage, and we need to make sure that we have adequate capacity. There's a question of how we should utilize this resource at different levels, including the 3.5 gigahertz citizens broadband, the super Wi-Fi, the TV white space area, and the gigabit Wi-Fi through the 5 gigahertz band. Cisco research, for example, has projected that more than 50% of all the IP traffic by 2016 is going to be through Wi-Fi networks. So we need to figure out what is the best way to maintain the opportunities for innovation that is so vital for our overall economy. To help us understand the benefits and barriers to wireless spectrum, we have brought together an outstanding set of speakers. Dr. Charles Jackson is an electrical engineer who's worked extensively in telecommunications and wireless. He is the principal at Jackson Telecom Consulting. He's been both a digital designer and a systems programmer. He works as a consultant and also is an adjunct professor at George Washington University, where he has taught graduate courses on mobile communications, wireless networks, computer security, and the internet. He consults on technology issues, primarily wireless and telecommunications, for a range of different companies. Tom Nagel is the Senior Vice President for Business Development Strategy for Communications and Data Services at Comcast. In that position, he's responsible for the strategic development of the company's wireless activities. He leads the firm's deployment and expansion of Xfinity Wi-Fi, which encompasses the creation of cable Wi-Fi. He began his career at Comcast in 2002 as Vice President of Business Development for Comcast Voice Services. And prior to joining Comcast, Tom acted as Vice President of Business Development at Gemini Networks and also Vice President of Business Development at Cox Communications. Juanita Budd is the Executive Director of Austin Freenet. In that position, she is responsible for the strategic vision regarding program and service delivery. She's working very hard to eradicate the digital divide and extend various internet networks to rural areas as well as underserved populations. Her organization was a recipient of a major grant from the Broadband Technology Opportunity Program run by the Department of Commerce, and previously she served in various positions for the Texas Girl Scouts. Our last speaker is Michael Calabrese. He is the director of the Wireless Future Program at New America Foundation. There he focuses on policies that promote connectivity, including spectrum policy reform, mobile market competition, and wireless broadband deployment, among others. He's worked there with financial support from Google and Microsoft, among others. He's a member of the U.S. Department of Commerce Spectrum Management Advisory Committee, and he also has served as an invited expert on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, specifically with its Spectrum Reform Working Group. So I'm going to start with Chuck. Maybe you can provide us with an overview of recent unlicensed wireless policy. Can you help us assess how we used unlicensed spectrum? Where have we been successful? Where have we failed?
Well, I'll try to be brief. I mean, there were sort of two generations of unlicensed wireless in the United States, and from the very early days, it was recognized there were some kinds of use of radio where the costs of licensing would exceed the benefits, and where the systems didn't have much potential for creating interference. And so the FCC for decades tolerated, yeah, that's about what the attitude was there, devices like remote, you know, garage door openers, cordless phones. Then in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a bunch of staff analysis of the FCC said, you know, we should really have a service where you can use relatively powerful radios, much more powerful than garage door openers, the kind of power we have today in modern Wi-Fi radios, and a relatively large band and some technical rules that prevent devices from being too terrible a source of interference, that if you regulate the production of the devices, that will be adequate for seeing that they don't create too much harm when they're deployed and turned on. And in the early to mid-80s, the FCC staff was able to convince the commissioners to put these ideas out for discussion. Industry was somewhere between neutral and opposed. I think academia and the public interest community was conspicuously silent. But this initiative that came out of the FCC staff basically ended up in the modern unlicensed rules about 1985, or something akin to them. And a few years later, the industry started taking off wireless LANs. You had the FCC policy initiative together with improvements in electronics. We can build, I mean, I don't know quite what the proper adjectives are to use in a place like this, but quite amazing electronics today. Very strong terms indeed, and systems that would have cost millions of dollars today are now, I mean, three decades ago, are now nickel and dime devices inside units, and smaller, lighter, better. And so we've seen an enormous explosion of such devices over the last few decades. Apple Computer lobbied for additional wireless unlicensed wireless spectrum, and the FCC followed up on that. And so the amount of spectrum that's now devoted to unlicensed is actually quite large. 500 megahertz or something, depends on how you want to count, mostly the 5 gigahertz. There's a tremendous large band at 5 gigahertz, which is where the fastest Wi-Fi devices are available. There's a real ecosystem building there, all kinds of interesting stuff, and I think one of the policy goals should be to expand that pool. If you're interested in this history, there was a conference about 4 or 5 years ago at George Mason University Law School on the genesis of modern unlicensed policy, and there are papers and presentations there, and there's a couple of very good papers, or three very papers on this history if you're interested in it.
Okay. Tom, I know you've been focusing on the next generation of Wi-Fi, including the gigabit Wi-Fi at the 5 gigahertz band level. What opportunities do you see, and what are you focusing on?
Well, thanks for having me. I think it's fun to be able to get out and talk about one of these issues is, I think, near and dear to Comcast generally, but I think to the communications and technology industry as a whole. You know, when I look at unlicensed for us, and I look at, you know, I see I'm sort of wearing two hats. One is one of the key strategy people at Comcast, but also as a user. And I'll come at it from the user standpoint first. You know, all of us are using Wi-Fi, and we all know how it works. What all the studies are showing us today is that Wi-Fi is really almost the predominant broadband access method today. Inside of our homes, we have more and more devices that are using Wi-Fi. We probably each of us have multiple devices that we take home and use, whether it's a laptop, whether it's our TV now that connects via Wi-Fi. It also is our tablets, our cell phones. And so when we began to see that over the last few years, one of the things we wanted to do as a company was to be able to begin to serve our customers and provide what we do inside the home to our customers with high-speed data, and do it outside to be a wireless extension, in a sense, for what you do inside the home. And that's what I've been focusing on the last few years, is really building out Xfinity Wi-Fi. So, you know, when I look at what's going on in the Wi-Fi ecosystem, and you look at it started out, as Chuck was mentioning, it was just sort of like an afterthought to a large degree. But it was one of those afterthoughts that didn't have a lot of rules around it that allowed anybody to have almost low barriers to entry. And what you saw is a tremendous investment to build an ecosystem when no one believed it could exist. Everyone at that point in time believed that sort of a up and down nature and license spectrum was the only way to really do these types of things. And so it just happened. And I think it happened because there were very few rules, but the rules that were there allowed it to flourish. It had higher power. It had the ability to have very low barriers to entry, no licensing. And so you found non-traditional companies, non-traditional people deploying Wi-Fi access points in that technology to get bigger and better and more important services to consumers. So I look at it, we began to do this, and what we've begun to do in the last couple of years is we built the nation's largest Wi-Fi network. So today, we probably have somewhere between 500,000 and a million hotspots that are deployed. We hope over time to be one of the world's largest Wi-Fi networks, if not the world's largest Wi-Fi network, with the whole goal being that we want to deliver more and more connectivity to our customers, not just inside their living rooms, but that's important to us as well, but to use that network that we have built that in order to provide it outside the footprint as well. The implications of that is we have hundreds of thousands of people that are using us on a monthly basis. And so we see things. One of the things we see is that traffic is triple-digit growth every year. It is in the Wi-Fi space, all of us see it. We're part of it. Is that we're doing more video on these devices. We're doing more video inside the home and outside the home. The Cisco reports show that Wi-Fi traffic is just going to explode, and it continues to explode. The implications of that are that what we have today is going to get more and more congested. And I think the challenge with that is that we've enjoyed a really good run with unlicensed spectrum, Wi-Fi specifically, where we've been able to do very creative things, provide services to our consumers in a way that they really, really enjoy it. That if we don't solve what is really becoming a spectrum crunch in unlicensed, that we will begin to have a tapering of that effect. And so I've been focusing, our company's been focusing on getting more and more unlicensed spectrum committed, and that the 5 gigahertz, as Chuck mentioned, the 5 gigahertz band is really the primary band for us to do that for a couple of different reasons. One is it already exists. So there's a portion of the 5 gigahertz band that we use for Wi-Fi today. It's the 5.8 gigahertz band. But there also are other portions of that band that have unlicensed, that are sort of in an unlicensed sort of space, but they have other rules that make it unusable, or they have other people that are in there. And so what we've been focusing on, and I think what's been read into the record today, I spent a lot of time at the FCC and with other folks that are interested in this space, talking about the different sub-bands of the 5 gigahertz. And one of the things we really strongly believe is that we're at a point now, we have almost all the data in front of us, that we think we can begin to move. And one of the things we'd love to see is we'd love to see the FCC begin to make a decision as quickly as possible about bringing more and more spectrum, especially into what one of the sub-bands called UNE1, and make a decision to put more and more spectrum into the UNE1 band and make that available for what we would consider traditional Wi-Fi. If that happens, which we think that could happen very, very quickly, all the radios that have been deployed by us could immediately take advantage of it. And more importantly, it gives us a big enough swath of spectrum that what we do today in Wi-Fi, which we can do hundreds of megabits a second, you can then begin to enable gigabit types of speed. So think about that. I could take inside my home, even outside the home, I could begin to generate gigabits of type of speed to my devices, to whatever I want to do, and think of the business models and the types of technology that would enable. So our primary goal right now is to get more and more unlicensed spectrum dedicated in the 5 gigahertz band.
I know it's out of turn for me to respond now, but it didn't just happen. There were about half a dozen FCC staffers who wanted to design a radio service that would allow this kind of innovation to flourish. I was an observer of it at the time. I was working at the Hill. It wasn't me. I wasn't one of them. I wish I had been. But it was people like Carlos Roberts, Mike Marcus, Mike Kennedy, a couple others. And they wanted to design a radio service that would allow this kind of flexible innovation to occur without mother may I from the FCC. So it may have been happenstance by some of the commissioners who voted for it, but it wasn't by the people who designed the policy.
And I think one of the great things, and this is the last thing I'll say for right now, but one of the great things about that is that when you think about what they started and where we've come from, and think about the fact that Wi-Fi generally is taking more traffic off of devices than any other network that's available to a consumer today. That's pretty astounding given that beginning.
Okay, let's bring Juanita into this discussion. So you're on the front lines of innovation at Austin Freenet. So could you tell us a little bit about the services you provide, how you're trying to eradicate the digital divide for rural users, elderly people, women, and other underserved populations? You mentioned you have a mobile lab, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, too.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel in the net with these superheroes up here, but I do my best. I'm in the nonprofit industry. And what my organization does is we try to eradicate the digital divide. We serve people, the underserved communities, and that is people with or with internet access or limited access, the elderly, homeless, ex-offenders, or people who just don't know how to use the computer. We partner with over 30 agencies in Austin, Texas, and through the Broadband Technology Opportunity Grant, we were able to provide them with computers and people to help train. We can put 1 million computers in a room, but if they don't know how to, people don't know how to use them, they're of no good to us. And so what we also learned is, okay, now we have the computers. Now that we have the trainers, we need the connectivity and devices, and the unlicensed spectrum is a great opportunity for us to use. We use it through Wi-Fi and the TV white space. It's a great space, you know, because it penetrates walls and trees, and you can get a lot of uses out of that. We're also a supporter of the unlicensed spectrum because $60 billion is generated annually with the licensed spectrum, which is a part of the U.S. Treasury. But you can go from 16 to about $52 billion annually through unlicensed spectrum. The other thing is we take laptops and deploy them to other agencies or areas like rural areas using hotspots, and people flourish to their areas that they are their anchor institutions like nonprofit organizations or libraries, and then they come in to learn those functions. Most people don't care about computers until they need to understand why they need computers. Do you all in this room understand the benefit of having computer access? But people that I work with need computer access just to apply for jobs, and they don't know how to use the computers to apply for a job. It sounds like it's so ancient, but that's what happens when you're not connected with technology. And so our goal is to eradicate the digital divide using any spectrum, licensed or unlicensed, but particularly the unlicensed spectrum to help us achieve the goal. Some of the policies that we think that would be beneficial for people, particularly that I serve, are the unlicensed white TV white space, because it's available and there's lots of it. Thank you.
Okay, Michael, so we've heard some discussions about the opportunities in the 5 gigahertz space. I know you've worked on citizens' broadband service at the 3.5 gigahertz area. What do you see as the opportunities, and what would you like to see us do?
Right. The Federal Communications Commission currently has a proceeding where they've proposed a citizens' broadband service from 3550 megahertz possibly up to 3,700 megahertz, about 150 megahertz, which is almost twice as wide as the current Wi-Fi band at 2.4 gigahertz, which would basically share federal spectrum. It's used mostly by the Navy offshore for naval radar, but it's, you know, 95% of the places and times in the United States that spectrum is empty. And, in fact, there's about 1,000 megahertz of spectrum like that, from 2700 megahertz up to 3700 megahertz, that the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology identified as a potential spectrum superhighway. It's almost all federal or mixed federal and private spectrum. It has things like radar systems that where it could be open for shared access. And, you know, the reason we're so high on opening that spectrum, primarily for effectively unlicensed use, but, you know, also for some licensed priority access use, is really, you know, what Tom was mentioning is the opportunity now. You have TV unlicensed access to the vacant TV channels. TV white space will help with filling some of the coverage gaps, you know, in rural areas, through additional walls, et cetera. But you need unlicensed spectrum at every different propagation, just as you have licensed spectrum at every propagation, to really get the greatest utility. And the thing about now getting much more capacity getting toward that gigabit Wi-Fi is that it's really possible with more small cell spectrum. The reason you can even think about this really high capacity at affordable prices using unlicensed is because the secret sauce of Wi-Fi is small cells, which means spectrum reuse. So Ruth Milkman, who was the chief of the Wireless Bureau, who's now Chairman Wheeler's chief of staff, she mentioned recently that, a Comcast Wi-Fi network, for example, has 30, in the same, in a given area, has 30 times the capacity that a carrier network has, like an AT&T or Verizon. And the reason is because they're reusing the spectrum over small areas, like you do in your home, like Brookings does in this building. It doesn't spread the same capacity over a square kilometer. And so that's really going to be how we solve the spectrum crunch, the so-called spectrum crunch that's arising from these incredible, 60% a year growth rate in mobile data demand. We can only do that through spectrum reuse. And in fact, the good news is we already are doing it. So in other words, the single unlicensed spectrum is the single biggest factor in meeting exploding mobile data demand. It already is. So in the United States, about 35% of mobile data traffic is already offloaded over Wi-Fi, more than 50% in Western Europe, according to the European Commission. And those numbers are headed within a few years to over 60% here and over 80% in Europe, again, according to a recent European Commission study. So what's happening essentially is consumers are choosing, for a whole variety of reasons, to put their mobile data traffic wherever possible onto an unlicensed network. And that totally makes sense, because the key distinction you have to realize is that nomadic is the new mobile. What I mean by that is you have to distinguish between truly mobile use of these devices, which is increasingly the minority, right? So truly mobile use means on the go. You're running to the bus stop, you're out in the woods, you're speeding in a car at 60 miles an hour. But nomadic use is when you're at home, at work, in a coffee shop, increasingly almost everywhere today where you're within 100 or 200 feet of a wireline, because that can be connected, because basically unlicensed spectrum can connect you over a short distance at low power to a fast wireline connection where somebody's already paying for, and so it's very cheap to offload your data traffic. And so already, what's driving mobile data demand is video. 85%, according to Cisco surveys, 85% of video on mobile devices is nomadic. In other words, it's at home. 85% is at home or work, and only about 10% is on the go, places where you might need a carrier network. So the carrier networks will still be important. They're a great niche service for obviously for mobility, for quality of service, but increasingly the way we're going to meet demand is through small cell spectrum reuse, sending your bits a short distance at low power directly into a wireline over shared spectrum. And this 3.5 band proceeding, the Citizens Broadband Service, would greatly expand on small cell spectrum. It would use the TV bands database, which governs unlicensed access to the vacant TV channels. It expands on that concept following the recommendation of the PCAST, and would provide a combination of effectively unlicensed access, which it calls general authorized access, across the entire band, together with some priority access by anybody, whether it's Comcast, Verizon, Best Buy, anybody who wants to pay for interference protection in a small area, using part of the band for that purpose.
So, Chuck, Juanita was talking about the opportunities in terms of TV white space. Michael was just emphasizing spectrum reuse. Are these the ways to go? Will this really take care of the
problem?
Yeah,
let me react briefly. First of all, I agree with almost everything Michael said, but to put it in context, the wireless industry is also going to go to small cells, and the Verizons and AT&Ts are going to build small cells that can use Wi-Fi, or they can use other technologies in the Wi-Fi space. Qualcomm claims that if you use LTE and Wi-Fi, it's more efficient. I mean, in unlicensed space, it's more efficient than Wi-Fi. But that the small cell vision is the only way we're going to get the kind of capacity growth that people forecast for a more widely connected world. And I think his model of nomadicity as being the primary source of wireless demand is correct. I personally think that the concept of using the TV white space is somewhat overblown. But the mechanisms people have developed to do it, like a real-time database that will allow much more carefully controlled sharing between an unlicensed type use and licensed incumbents in a band that are only in some geographic areas, is a big win of a technology. If you know, back in 1985, you couldn't build an unlicensed device and put it in a band that was full of important licensed users, because somebody would buy one and take it wherever they wanted. But if you have a mechanism that says, well, there's this important band that's used by the Air Force in Arizona and really not much anywhere else, a couple other locations, we now have the technology to put devices in there that will basically call home and say, is it okay to use it? I know where I am because of GPS. Can I please use it? And it'll say yes or no. So that's a technology that's going to be tremendously liberating in terms of facilitating sharing. And if anybody wants to talk to me about why I'm pessimistic on the TV white spaces, it just has to do with market incentives and things like that. And I think these higher frequencies offer larger blocks of continuous spectrum, which will allow higher speeds and support the kinds of high-speed browsing and file transfer people want.
Well, for us, it's been a great resource. We threw a mesh over our Houston area, and people who can't afford these services, hundreds of thousands of them, are using this white space for daily use and daily functions. They don't know about the broadband and how important it is. I think there's a benefit for both unlicensed and licensed, but clearly most of the mechanisms and everything that we're developing today is under the unlicensed spectrum because they don't have the regulations of the FCC or the regimented responsibilities of getting licensed to perform activities.
Oh, no, I'm a big fan of unlicensed. I mean, I think that it makes an enormous contribution to our society, and there's a difficult policy choice that we have to make, is how much spectrum do we use as licensed and how much do we use as unlicensed? And I think we have no reliable analytic guides to drawing that boundary. It's just people are, you know, it's the way they feel, you know. It's aesthetic.
So, Tom, I mean, you were mentioning this, you know, the growing mobile usage, the congestion that's taking place. What would you like to see the FCC do to address these issues?
Well, the first thing I'd like them to do is make a ruling on the lower band of 5 gigahertz. I think, you know, we've had this ruling out, or the NPRM out for a while. I think we have a lot of facts that have been read into the record. I think it's probably time to act. I think they have enough information in front of them. They have a lot of engineering studies, all the things that we as a collective group do to help inform them. They're also very, very smart people. So I think that it's time for us to decide, you know, how to begin to attack the lower band of 5 gigahertz. The goal that we would have would be to take the whole lower band of the 5 gigahertz and contribute it into the unlicensed spectrum. There's only one incumbent in that band. And it has very, very sort of a small set, very specialized set of users in the United States. And so we think that is an easy decision to make and one we'd like to see happen now. The upper band of 5 gigahertz is another chunk that's available. It's called the UNE-4. That's sort of a little more complex. It has the auto industry's interests where they want to go create sort of like a car-to-car communication grid, where if I can't see you, I'm told that you're turning a corner, my car can predict you're going to turn into the wrong lane and somehow avoid you and those types of things. So it has safety of life, and I think we're all supportive of that, though I think what's been shown is that having 70 to 100 megahertz available for safety of life probably isn't necessary. I think so up in the UNE-4 band, we'd love to see maybe more of a collaborative effort. We'd love to see the FCC get involved in that and making sure that both sides, those that need the unlicensed spectrum and those that have the license, sort of are forced to work together. And I think to come up with a solution, because I think one thing's in the upper band, what's happening is that if you look at sort of the auto industry, you know, they've had it for 15 years. They've done a little with it. Their promise is 20 years from now, so that's been a 35-year sort of process, and that's 100 megahertz that's unutilized. And yet all of us, all the way from license holders and unlicensed users, we recognize that we need that band. That band's really important, or a portion of that band, to begin to digest. So I'd like to see them begin to maybe put a little more elbow grease into that for both sides, making us work more closely together, maybe asking harder questions rather than just asking, are you working together? Yes. Maybe it's like, okay, let's make sure the proposals are reasonable. Make sure that when it's compromised, it doesn't always go one way. So that's another piece I think would be really, really important. You know, it's interesting, too, we talk about these different bands, and I think when we think unlicensed, one thing that's true about unlicensed is we have no idea what the business model is going to be for it. And I think that it'd be a mistake for us to try to decide that unlicensed and this band is going to be best for this and that. Because in reality, who would have thought, you know, 3 years ago that Comcast would have put hundreds of millions of dollars into building a, sort of like a pseudo wireless network, a pseudo licensed network, but it's on unlicensed. There are downsides to unlicensed. It's more challenging, even though it doesn't, even though licensed guys are going to you know, small cells, they can manage that interference much better. Wi-Fi doesn't do that. And so there's challenges to it. So I think there are a lot of different constituents that have interest and they can utilize unlicensed. So the more you put into it, the more likely it is we'll come up with newer technologies that solve different problems. And I think, you know, I'd love to see the FCC put more into it, put more elbow grease behind it, but not put a lot of rules around unlicensed, because I just don't know what's going to happen in 5 years.
So, Michael, should we have a use-it-or-lose-it approach to spectrum? Like some people have said, the Defense Department is sitting on spectrum but not using it. Tom suggested the auto industry may be doing the same thing. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, actually, we've been calling it a use-it-or-share-it. In theory, we have a use-it-or-lose-it model now that never happens. They never lose it. It just you know, sits fallow, and there's one extension or excuse after another. So what we proposed is that, particularly, you know, at least starting certainly with federal spectrum, the federal spectrum bands, that it should be use it or share it. In other words, the incumbents who are licensed, whether it be Defense Department, or I would say it could even be, you know, some commercial entity, they can be protected from harmful interference, and unlicensed users need to work around them. But if you can, then, you know, you should be able to, because, you know, spectrum is a very unique resource. It's not like oil or gas or trees, even. Maybe it's like trees, but in incredibly rapid fashion. In other words, it's infinitely renewable. In other words, every second that goes by that you don't use spectrum capacity, you've wasted that forever. So fallow spectrum is, you know, there's just no reason. And even the communications law is structured so that nobody has ownership. You know, licensees don't have ownership, right? They have a maximum of around 10 years of a license, and their license is for their use, not for the capacity of the spectrum. And that's really where the PCAST focused in their report in 2012, is they basically said, and in fact the president did in his executive memorandum that came out last June, adopt the policy that the federal government should share spectrum to the greatest extent possible. And that's the premise of this 3.5 gigahertz band that I was, you know, mentioning earlier, the proposed citizens broadband service that's used mainly by the Navy, is where the spectrum is fallow, then let the private sector come in, and whether it's on an unlicensed basis or a priority access basis, which the commission has proposed, for example, a mix of those two at 3.5 gigahertz, that the private sector ought to be able to go in there, and you can use mechanisms like a geolocation database to ensure that you don't cause interference, harmful interference to the incumbent service. So, for example, if the Navy wins its argument that you shouldn't be able to operate, you know, right on the coastline, well, okay, then a database can enforce that, and you can operate everywhere else, that the Navy isn't sailing through the cornfields of Iowa, and that would be the idea of. You know, if the capacity is not in use, then let's use it. And the technologies both the automated governance mechanism of the TV bands database, which can be generalized, as well as dynamic spectrum technology and sensing. All those things exist now and are becoming more economic to deploy for this purpose.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, if you can give us your name and your organization. There's a gentleman right here. There's a microphone that's coming up. And by the way, those of you standing in back, we do have some empty seats in the front row if you would like to sit.
My name is Richard Bennett. I'm a visiting fellow at American Enterprise Institute and one of the people that developed Wi-Fi in 1990. Seems to me there are two areas of controversy. One of them, Chuck talked about the Tom Nagel talked about the 5.9 gigahertz, where there's sort of a technical conflict between different uses of that. The other one is TV white spaces, the use of TV white spaces for unlicensed, which has some technical implications that I don't think have really been fully explored. I'd like to hear maybe from the panel about what the rationale is for assigning low-band spectrum to unlicensed uses and how you see us developing a coordination system to ensure that that spectrum is actually used after it's assigned.
Anybody wants to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I could start, I guess, in reference to, I mean, the low-band spectrum for unlicensed, well, there is some at 900 megahertz, of course, currently, which you're probably most familiar with at home on perhaps a cordless phone, particularly the old cordless phones, and wireless internet service providers. These are sort of, there's about 2,000 mom-and-pop internet service providers, fixed wireless providers around the country, mostly in rural, small-town areas, that rely on unlicensed spectrum. And they use some 900 megahertz spectrum. That's low band, right? And the distinctive characteristic of low band is that it covers large areas, mainly its coverage. So it covers large areas with the same amount of equipment, about four times the area at the same cost. So then it makes it economical in less densely populated areas. It also, and this is really important both in more remote areas as well as in cities, is it penetrates. So you know how you can probably get TV reception in your basement with an antenna. It's the same thing. Those signals cut through walls and trees, which makes it really great for remote areas as well as for getting inside buildings. So there were community wireless deployments in low-income areas. For example, one I worked with a bit in Chicago where, you know, they were trying to, in an area with 50% below poverty, trying to get the use Wi-Fi very economically to get folks online, but you couldn't get the signals into the building through that outer wall, whereas you can with TV white space. So I guess, to Richard's question, the FCC voted, believe it or not, now it's been over 5 years, unanimously in November 2008 and then again in September 2010 to permit unlicensed access to many of the vacant TV channels. The rules are incredibly conservative about protecting television broadcasting, so the majority of vacant channels, so in D.C., you know, there's only about, 10 TV stations over the air at the most out of 48 channels, and yet there's only 5 or 6 so-called white space channels. The reason is the rules are incredibly conservative. Most vacant channels are still blocked off to protect distant markets, in case somebody's watching Baltimore here, for example. But those channels that are open, it's governed by a geolocation database. So the rules require that your device has to check the database every 24 hours and get a list of vacant and safe channels where you're located. And so far it's working great. There's been a lot of deployments, as Juanita said, and I've worked on some at West Virginia University, other places. There's a whole big deployment going on up in Garrett County, Maryland, funded by the Appalachian Regional Commission to extend broadband to 3,000 homes that are completely unserved that rely on dial-up using a white space network. They'll check the database to make sure that the channel is still safe to use every 24 hours. And that's the premise. The commission is using that concept as a foundation for the for governing the access to this Navy band, the 3.5 gigahertz citizen broadband service, because it's you know, we just need to get to the next generation of it, make it a little more sophisticated. The big cloud of uncertainty, to finish, is of course the TV incentive auctions. The FCC is in the midst of deciding the reallocation of another big tranche of TV band spectrum for auction, and which means that the broadcasters need to be repacked. It means a lot of the white space is going to go away, and it's just unclear if there will be a sufficient amount of unlicensed in every market nationwide, which we really need in order to have national markets for the chips, the devices, the services. And that's what's going to get us to use white space, TV band unlicensed, not just for fixed wireless, for things that Juanita's doing now, but also to get the 802.11 AF standard, which is, in other words, a Wi-Fi, you know, device-to-device standard, so the customers, so that basically that interface can be built into your tablets and so on, because now 92% of tablets are used only on Wi-Fi, and it'd be great if, for example, they could have a direct air interface to white space as well as other unlicensed bands.
And just to add one thing, great. Response. I really appreciate that. I ditto everything he says, but think about in a national disaster when a lot of things go down. We need a band that's going to be able to be resilient to those natural disasters and ensure that people get out where they most need it. So I think that would be helpful with that use of that unless it's white space.
Tom, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, there's a couple things that TV white space has some unique aspects to it. You know, it does penetrate broadly, it's a low band, so it has a lot of energy in it. It can go through walls. I think the challenge is that it really is not a great methodology to cover people in an urban environment. You have too much density of humans in a urban environment in the coverage. You know, a lot of times coverage, we feel like coverage is always good, and coverage is not always good. The bigger circle I draw, it's a quadratic equation that says I'm going to have that many more people inside the circle. So what happens is it will down power. In an urban environment, you down power, you need more, you know, you can reproduce them. So there's good stuff to it. Don't get me wrong. I like it. The challenge is inside of a city, there's just not enough bands. I think there's just not enough tonnage. And I think if I look at sort of where TV, we've been at it for 5 years. It's going to be a few more years more because we have no idea what the auctions are going to do. The development of the technology has been sort of slow, the adoptions, all these things. So I think it's fine to continue to push down that path. I'm a little skeptical of the operationalization in a urban environment. Rural, it's a great product. I think it's a perfect product for rural. To extend the suburbs to the exurbs, I think that's great. But in a suburban to an urban, I'm very doubtful of it. It'd be great if it would work. So when I think of like the things that are in front of us, TV white space, you know, happy to spend time on that. If we're looking at unlicensed spectrum, the 5 gigahertz is by far. If I had a scale from 1 to 10, I'd put TV white space at a 2 to 3. I'd put the 5 gigahertz at a 9 or 10, and a 3.5 probably somewhere in the 5s relative to priority of where to spend our time. Because what's going to happen is we're going to have to spend, if we spend so much time in TV white space, the challenge will be is that where the preponderance of the need is, of the capacity need, we will miss it. And the capacity need is where there are people with devices utilizing the spectrum. That's where the crunch exists. So I agree with Juanita, though. The TV white space is by far the best product that I've seen to extend. There's no question that in the rural environment, I think, you know, it's almost like a go as fast as you can.
Chuck?
Yeah, a couple observations in this. And one, just you were talking about the 5.9, the higher. Something that illustrates some of the facts that lie behind his analysis. The auto industry has been developing standards for a number of years. As I understand, their most recent one is something like 802.11p, if I'm correct. And it's one that's basically taken standard Wi-Fi and modified it for the highway environment. And their argument is, well, geez, you know, they're building a good fraction of a billion chips every year. They're really inexpensive, and and people have spent enormous amounts of time trying to think of how to make these things work. There's no way the automobile industry could ever fund the R&D necessary to build something better than Wi-Fi for short-range communication. So we're going to just take Wi-Fi and we'll make a few little tweaks to it that are inexpensive, and then we'll make it better for this highway communication task. But fundamentally, we're going to use the same chips in the same way. Mm-hmm. And it's the existence of that huge ecosystem of devices, manufacturers, applications, together with a large block of spectrum that is so important. And that's, I think that's what he sees as the vision, and the fact that the highway industry wants to, you know, they may want to let those guys in, but they sure want to use all the technology they're developing, and it's, it illustrates how important that is. As for the, I mean, I think the strongest, well, it's not a criticism, but the TV white space rules have been in place for 5 years. From what we've heard, there may be 10, 15,000 devices built for it. There are going to be that many Wi-Fi devices sold in the U.S. today.
And last hour.
Yeah. Well, last
30 minutes.
Since we've been speaking. I don't know. I didn't think it was that high, but I didn't do the calculation. But the problem with one of the problems of the TV white space is just the nature of the market. The devices have to be complicated because of the technical rules. They don't provide very much bandwidth because of both the limited spectrum and the technical rules. So if you can use 5 gigahertz instead, instead of going at 10 megabits per second, you're going to go to 500 a gigabit per second, and you'll transfer your files 100 or 1,000 times faster. And then the utility in urban areas is going to be difficult for the reasons he described. So maybe 10, 20% of the population of the U.S. is a natural market. So you have no wonder they haven't sold any. And I think that these impediments to the market will continue. As for the different coverage at different frequencies, we could go on for a long time. Building penetration at frequencies varies with the type of building. Foliage penetration does pretty much vary with frequency. And the usual equation that shows that higher frequencies don't go as far as lower frequencies gives that result only if you misinterpret it. With modern technologies like 802.11ac, it's just not right. And if you want rural coverage, use satellites.
Okay. Other questions? Right here's a gentleman with a question.
Thank you. Srinivas Bala from Light Squared. I think just talk about two innovations. This is for you, Charles. One is the Li-Fi, which is broadband through the LED lights in the visible wavelengths. Some of the Asian countries, including China, is doing testing on it. I wonder where U.S. is from that front. The second innovation from a technology perspective is from Stanford called Kumu Networks, where they promise instead of having FDD like 10 by 10 pair on spectrum, they said on a single block of spectrum I can do both receive and transmit simultaneously. I just want to see your views on that. A third point is the FCC and especially Department of Treasury looks at the spectrum auctions as a way of revenue generation, and now with all this unlicensed spectrum coming up, what would their opinion be like? I mean, I know this AWS-4 is coming, 600 megahertz auction coming up, and especially the Department of Treasury do see significant revenue sources in their budgets.
Well, that's a lot of questions. I'm not sure I can even remember them all. But with regard to using Wi-Fi over visible light, the original Wi-Fi 802.11 had an infrared option, but apparently people really like things that go around corners better than that. It is an example of a light really, it's a higher radio frequency. It doesn't go through the walls at all. But optical, optical and also 60 gigahertz where there is a standard, is it in place now? I think it's in place. And actually I think there's at least one product out. It offers enormous bandwidth, but only within a room or something like that. We're talking, what, tens?
It's probably, I think, 500 megahertz of spectrum.
I don't know. It's 7 gigahertz.
Is it that much that's available?
For the band, yeah. I don't know if the devices.
I don't think they spread that far, but you can do multi-gigabits inside of a room. So think of it this way, that you no longer have an HDMI cable. You put a device, and they just connect. That's what AC is about.
Yeah, it's no, that's not AC. That's
The 60 gigahertz.
Right. Yeah. Well, I can't remember. But I think you asked about the Stanford transmit and receive at the same time technology, and I mean it's possible on paper, but I think it's going to be hard to build. But I'm not that's not my kind of thing. You know, those guys who build radios do some wonderful stuff, but that's very challenging, as I understand it.
There's a few people that I know that can transmit and receive at the same time, but there are very few number of people who can do that.
Yeah, it's a very hard problem, and maybe they'll be able to make it work.
I think going forward.
Okay, right here in the aisle, there's a question.
Hello, I'm Mark Brodsky, retired physicist and engineer. You didn't talk much about the international implications. I mean, what about these policies would need international cooperation, agreement, treaties, coherence of technology? We ran into problems with the U.S. cellular technology going a different direction than European, and therefore travelers had difficult times. Can you also talk about the portability of apps that one might use in these spaces when you go international?
Well, I think one of the great, I mean, it's a good question. The beautiful thing about unlicensed is that once you establish a spectrum at unlicensed, you can do a lot of things with it. Wi-Fi is a perfect example. So I just did the calculation. You know, we were talking about how many are shipped in an hour. There's 50 million chips that are shipped in an hour.
What?
50 million. There's 400 million units shipped in the United States in a year of Wi-Fi that have Wi-Fi in them. I think that comes out to
50,000.
I'm sorry, 50,000 an hour. So it's more. It's close. It's working me here. I got a physicist over here. I got the guy that created Wi-Fi. I'm clearly in a very technical room. But I appreciate the check. That was very helpful. Anyway, so it's a lot more than 15. So the fact is that there are a bunch of chips that are shipped. So the international cooperation in this is simple in the sense that if we add spectrum to Wi-Fi, especially in the 5 gigahertz, it doesn't matter. The chips accept it. The chips work with it. It automatically will work. So the seamlessness worldwide is that the billions and billions of chips that have shipped since the beginning and all the IP and all the development that's happened since then, it is immediately attributable to that new band.
Yeah, there's more. The 5 gigahertz unlicensed band was adopted fairly widely internationally because it harmonized with previous something called the ISM band that was internationally allocated. So it was easier to adopt, unlike TV white space devices built to U.S. standards will maybe be sold in Canada and Mexico or something, but it doesn't create the same kind of global market. There are some funny things that go on because different nations have slightly different rules. So the devices come and they say, well, tell me which country I'm in so that I won't break the rules. And sometimes they can be configured at time of shipment, and hackers could vary it so you could use channels that you're not supposed to be using in a particular country, and there's some of that occurs. But there's widespread international harmonization at 5 gigahertz, and the incumbent systems with which that may need to be moved or relocated are pretty much harmonized internationally. So if you can find a way to work it out in the United States, that solution will probably also propagate internationally.
Okay. Jim has a question. There's a microphone coming up.
Do we just make him a liberal arts major instead of a physicist? That would be great.
Jim Snyder from iSolid. My question is directed to Daryl, who's the only political scientist on the panel, and it concerns, in general, the health of spectrum politics and, in particular, the health of unlicensed spectrum politics. So I think with regard to certain bands, like the federal reallocations, policy may be a significant part of the variables affecting the decision. And other bands like the TV band, I doubt very much that the type of policy considerations here are going to be material. That's going to be driven by power politics.
Actually, could you speak more into the microphone?
Power politics behind the scenes. So one of the issues that disturbs me about spectrum politics is I go to a lot of events like this, and you have these experts who are on these panels, and I generally know before they open their mouths what they're going to say based on who their clients are, but they don't present themselves that way on these panels. They present themselves as experts, and they talk that way, and I consider that a problem. Now, there may be certain sympathetic reasons why that happens. For example, in the licensed versus unlicensed debate, the telecom companies are big advocates for license, and Silicon Valley is a big advocate for unlicensed. Silicon Valley has a problem with directly advocating because Google and Microsoft are producing devices that they have to sell to the telecom companies, the iPhones and whatnot. They don't want to directly spit in the face of their clients, so they hire academics or think tanks, analysts, do their lobbying for them. And they also get a tax break when they do that, because they're 501(c)s. So maybe that should be sympathetic. They're in a difficult position, but I find it a problem. You know, when you see an expert on TV, they're expected to reveal their interest, and they don't get invited back unless they do. And that's just not the case here, or the FCC is having also an event right now on spectrum sharing, and there will be academics there, and I doubt very much they're going to disclose where they're coming from, or consultants. And I think that should be an important part of these discussions. I think it would strengthen, you know, the politics of what's really going on in some of these events. So what do you think of, you know, the spectrum politics as it goes on in this context and more generally in Washington, D.C.?
No, that certainly is a very good point. We know there's a lot of self-interested politics in Washington, D.C. I mean, when we put our panels on, we try and get a range of views. With Juanita, for example, we wanted someone who's really on the front line, so we have kind of a representation of some private sector people, some nonprofit organizations, and so on. But I think, you know, the FCC is trying to balance a lot of different economic interests. I certainly don't envy them that. I think in the technology sphere in general, they have like the established players, but the politics are complicated by the new entrants who are coming into the field. And so it creates real problems for the FCC as well as in Congress. So, you know, we kind of look at governance questions in general here and how those types of decisions play out. I mean, it's one of the reasons we put on these types of events to try and give some sense of how these issues play out and what we think should be done.
I think it's a fundamentally flawed analysis that Jim offers. One, people present arguments and you have to judge the arguments, not... It's interesting to know who funded them or how they developed their prejudices. But what counts is the arguments, not the voice. And in my case, I have consulted in this area for clients. I haven't done it in a few years. I advocated for unlicensed before unlicensed was cool. I can show you stuff that I wrote in the 70s and 80s about this. So whatever. My arguments are right or wrong, independent of where I came from or what I did. And I think in terms of politics in America and spectrum policy, one, we have a problem that we have sort of two spectrum regulatory sides. We have the federal government and we have the FCC, and there isn't a place where the buck stops. We have a flawed, we don't have a single good decision maker, and as a consequence, I don't think a variety of decisions like sharing with the federal government are addressed with the proper unified decision-making in a fashion that would be more likely to lead to the best outcome. And in terms of, it's not so much power politics, but I think the FCC will always view a request for spectrum from public safety agencies who aren't trying to line their own pocket, but rather serve the public. They will give that a very high consideration, even if those groups are perhaps doing their analysis a little quickly.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, this gentleman has right here is a question.
Jay Sang, Charles Jackson mentioned earlier, used a phrase about the lack of analytic methodology for looking at comparing licensed and unlicensed spectrum decisions of basing an analytic tool for basing these decisions. Can you say a little bit more about what the bases for these decisions are now and what you think a good analytic tool would be?
I'm not sure whether to use the word analytic tool, but a framework for making the choices for spectrum licensed and unlicensed.
He's got his watch out. Why don't we talk afterwards? I mean, the spectrum policy not just in the U.S., but the whole world, has been driven. It's like somebody skiing down the hill that they've never seen before, and something comes up and they turn one way or the other. It's driven by the development of markets, the development of technology, not quite happening as much as it used to, but for a long time, new technology allowed exploiting higher frequencies. We're talking about consumer devices at 5 gigahertz. I'm unfortunately old enough to remember when people said, oh, it's impossible to have mobile service at 500 megahertz. And you're talking about the low bands at 900. Well, it used to be impossible to do radio, you know, consumer radios at 900. It was ridiculous. Now we've got them at 5 gigahertz, and people carry them around, lots of them around in their pocket. So when we had these bands open up, they create new opportunities for making rules. Different interest groups come in and say, we want some. It gets passed out, and then there's inertia. There used to be a rule of thumb. We'd split it half with the federal government, half with the civil sector. That's deep analysis leads to that. So we have these structures that reflect our history and not our current technology or our current needs. And then we make incremental decisions. And that's the way the world works. And it may lead to outcomes that are far from efficient. And, I mean, we heard somebody here, heard him talk about, I shouldn't describe it in quite those terms, but talk about ways to arguably move towards more efficient use at 5 gigahertz and the effort it takes. And it's taken years, and it you know, I mean, as somebody who's not involved in that at all, except as a consumer of Wi-Fi, I think it's kind of a no-brainer, and it would be a shame we didn't do it a long time ago. But it's hard, and that's, you know, a reflection of our institutions.
Michael?
Yeah, it's both... It's good to talk about this again because it's really both, a blessing and a curse for unlicensed spectrum that you really, the regulators can't stand here and you know, today and reasonably say what actually will happen on that band, you know, in the future, nor should they. Unlicensed, I think it was Tom mentioned earlier, that the idea that one of its appeals is innovation without permission. Like the Internet itself, it's open to anybody. and that can be a great attraction. In fact, that's actually part of the purpose, I think, for this 3.5 gigahertz band, the proposed citizens broadband service. Part of what the commission is effectively saying, certainly what we're arguing, is that for example, as we have these TV incentive auctions at 600 megahertz, when they have those auctions, they know pretty much who's going to bid on that spectrum, who's going to get it, and what they're going to use it for. It's a handful of companies that already have a business model, and, you know, partly because of the money, we'll auction it. But the 3.5 gigahertz band, like any additional unlicensed spectrum you might put out there, you're not sure who's going to use it or for what, and that's part of the appeal. It also makes it a little more difficult because there's not, you know, in a sense, money in hand for it. And in 3.5 gigahertz, for example, I mean, one of the great attractions that they can anticipate is that you'll get the same sort of economics you have with the Internet. In other words, distributed investment and deployment at the edge. You don't have to wait for a big network operator to come and deploy really expensive centralized infrastructure like you do at 600 megahertz after an auction. Instead, you'll have everyone from Comcast to Austin Freenet, you know, coming in and deploying. And whether you just have $10,000 to spend, you know, on 20 access points to serve a few hundred people, or millions of dollars to spend on a much broader, you know, Wi-Fi offload network, you can do that. Or you could be like a Best Buy, perhaps, and buy some connectivity and bake it into a device. There's all sorts of things we can't imagine. So it really cuts both ways, but it's very definite that with the unlicensed bands, you just don't know exactly what's going to rise up on it.
Gentleman over here has a question.
Hi, Matt Starr from CompTIA. I feel like when I first started paying attention to questions about the unlicensed space maybe 4 or 5 years ago, unlicensed was really viewed as kind of this hotbed of innovation. Michael kind of touched on this in his last answer. And I feel like the discussion in recent years has really moved towards Wi-Fi and small cell use for unlicensed spectrum. So I was just curious what the panelists feel like. Do you feel like this Wi-Fi is a hotbed for innovation, particularly for, you know, small companies who can't afford licensed spectrum to kind of innovate and create new uses for unlicensed spectrum? Does that concept still exist, or have we moved on past that?
I'll take that. I think it absolutely exists. I mean, I think that when you think about Wi-Fi, where it's come to, it's really become an enabling layer, right? It used to be all about just connecting a PC, a laptop, Intel's, inside. Back in the day where you'd have a card, you'd slide into the PCM CIA card slot, and it would connect to the Internet. Those days are long past. Really what Wi-Fi is the way to enable any device to get access to what it really needs, which is connectivity to the people around me or to the Internet as a whole. And that when you look where the innovation's happening, it's not happening in the Wi-Fi layer. Some of it is in the carrier layer and that kind of stuff, but it's really happening on top of that layer. So if you think about the Internet of Things and every device, think about how many connected devices you have inside your home 3 years ago, today, and 3 years from now. It's just ratcheting up. And that when you think about how all of these new industries, these new businesses that are going to start up, I mean, Nest is a perfect example. It started with a very smart designer with a concept that was a very, very, very expensive thermostat, and it just sold for $3.2 billion. It would not have been able to do that without Wi-Fi. That company would not exist. And there are a number of companies that would not exist without the basic fundamentals of having, getting to the Internet without the permission of a gatekeeper.
Yeah, but you shouldn't conflate unlicensed with just Wi-Fi. There's Zigbee, there's Bluetooth, and the rules are such that if they're not very constraining. They basically say if you build a radio, it can't be too strong, and it has to not have terrible interference characteristics. It's easy to test that a radio meets these. You can, So if you want a different standard, you think Wi-Fi is inefficient, you can build something different and bring it to market very easily. And it's a very open regulatory regime that way. The rules don't require Wi-Fi. The rules just require being a good neighbor.
And the difference between, I think, unlicensed and licensed is that it takes away really sort of an established gatekeeper. And I think that, and it's not just about someone saying yes or no, it's about the added cost of getting onto that licensed network, the added chip costs and sort of the stack of the whole ecosystem. The beautiful thing about unlicensed is the ecosystem's established. It has vast amount of deployment. So the ones you mentioned, Zigbee, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, all three of those have really gotten down a cost curve. So it's all about those economic elements too that make, the people above us, the higher order of part of the food chain, they can actually make a lot of money and create new jobs, new businesses, new concepts that we wouldn't have even thought about a few years ago.
Yeah, we've probably, I'm glad you brought it up, Matt, because we probably neglected the whole side of the Internet of Things, I mean, where unlicensed is going to be central. We focused a lot today, I think, on Wi-Fi offload and the millions of hotspots because, a real salient issue is exploding mobile data demand. It's the actual individual use of bandwidth, whether it's for streaming video, video calling, and so on. And we need to make, we want to meet that demand affordably on a ubiquitous basis, hopefully at higher speeds with 5 gigahertz and so on. But actually, it won't be long when, most of the connections and perhaps even most of the bandwidth will be all these devices, everything talking to everything else on your behalf and just giving you an update. And so, in fact, I think it was one of your members or staff told us at CompTIA, a few years ago that, you already have things like the dentist drill sends the dentist an email when it needs to be changed, when it's dull. And so that sort of thing will just be pervasive. Ericsson and others have, are estimating something on the order of 50 billion connected devices you know, by 2020. So, you know, everything in your home will be tied together. You know, you see all these home of the future things where you touch the countertop display and it tells you, you know, what recipes you could make based on what's in your refrigerator because it knows. So all that's going to be on unlicensed. I would really refer you to a terrific law journal article that Yochai Benkler at Harvard Law School wrote, published, I guess, almost exactly a year ago in the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology, where he talks about, you know, the economics of unlicensed, and he goes into about five of these verticals, smart grid, you know, and smart metering. The reason the U.S. is so far ahead of the world in smart meter deployments is it's all on unlicensed spectrum, whereas in Europe they're trying to do it through subscription, through carrier spectrum. And so it's much more quick and economical. Here, healthcare, Benkler found, you know, 85% of connected health devices are on unlicensed spectrum. Retail, obviously all inventory is going connected on unlicensed spectrum. I think probably primarily Bluetooth, not even Wi-Fi. So it's just getting into every different vertical and will be enormously important to be able to just connect directly over these short distances without
I can give you an anecdote that I heard this weekend that'll illustrate why this is true. This was this guy was involved at Rutgers, and there's a project where they're building some wireless, you know, with students designing, you know, this Internet of Things. But he said he saw this something like a crock pot, you know, those things that cook all day, where you could control it from your iPad or your iPhone instead of the knob on the front. He said, why on earth would you want to do that? But then if you look at the bill of materials and the cost of assembly, it's cheaper to put in the radio interface and use the display on the phone than it is. And, well, you know, those knobs cost money, and you got to have a switch behind it, and then you got to run wires to it, and you got to assemble it. You got to have a supporting structure. Well, all of a sudden, that costs a lot more than a radio nowadays. And so if you just have a radio, you know, a Wi-Fi radio, and then people pick it up on their, and then they get a nice display, you write the program once. So there are going to be economies that people hadn't considered about using communications and devices. And so, you know, it'll be even more pervasive than you think it's going to be.
Okay, in the aisle, there's a question.
Hi, my name's Shannon Delaney, and I'm with Honda. And just to preface, I have a GR background, not a technical background, so I'm not going to be asking a super technical question. But, you know, talking about opening up the 5.9 gigahertz spectrum for sharing, when we weighed in with the FCC on that NPRM, our big point was we wanted to see that any sort of sharing wasn't going to be detrimental to public safety. And so when we're talking about sharing, what's really the technical status of sharing where you have to really be making a very quick decision points as you're going down the highway, and it's not checking in every 24 hours to see if it's sharing, but if it's that real time, what is the status of that technology?
Well, I think that, so the response to the, I mean, inside all the different filings at the FCC, if you look at sort of what the audit industry has, they have a large swath, right? So the audit industry wants to maintain 100% of the large swath. The safety issue of car-to-car, that kind of stuff, can be, I think all of us would generally agree, could be in a much smaller band of that large swath. So the concept would be that you would take the safety of life issues and you move them, and you move them and you keep them contiguous, and you move them to a much smaller number of channels. Maybe out of the 100, you put them in a 30 megahertz block. The other stuff, which are things that the auto industry wants to do to sort of expand its business model to things like maps and all these other attributes, which would be nice to have, but are not safety of life. They're convenience issues. They may be safety conveniences, but they really aren't the car-to-car kind of stuff. Those would have the sharing regime. The safety of life, I think we all would agree, it makes no sense to share within that, provided that we can't come up with a fairly robust way of doing that. So I think what we would say is that sharing shouldn't exist. I mean, the safety of life doesn't need to exist across 100, whole 100 megahertz. Europe, I think, is using 30. We somehow have sort of logged on to 100. And so I think we would push the safety of life into a smaller band, take the remaining spectrum and create robust sharing, which exists today, which we know can make happen. So I think that's the basic concept of where we would end up, at least from our view.
Jim.
I asked a question about nonprofits.
So Jim Stein from iSolon. Follow-up with some Chuck, responding to your statement that what's important is not where a speaker is coming from, but the arguments that they make. I think most Americans would disagree with that type of analysis. When you listen to elite media, news media, they expect their sources to disclose where they're coming from. We have lobbyist disclosure because we expect the public wants to know when somebody is a lobbyist on federal advisory committees and whatnot. So my question with you, when I listen to you and I hear a statement like, why you're pessimistic about TV white spaces, and then you give some public policy reasons, but I know that you have been a major, one of your major clients over here has been the TV broadcast industry. I've been reading many of your comments on behalf of the TV broadcast industry attacking unlicensed spectrum in the TV ban with what I consider many controversial assumptions. So the question is, the general feeling is, maybe in this audience, I don't know, that people want to know, it's helpful to understand where somebody is coming from when they make these public policy statements. And I think you're disagreeing with that, and I just want, is the public unsound in wanting that type of information?
I don't know. My understanding is newspapers often publish things from anonymous sources, and they turn out to be interesting. You shouldn't really care whether what Einstein's religion was. You care whether his equations were right. But as a matter of fact, I did get paid to work on the TV white space issue by a company named Qualcomm that sells about as many Wi-Fi chips as anybody else. They've probably sold more Wi-Fi chips since we started talking.
I could probably calculate. I'm missing by an order of magnitude.
Pardon? I've read many of your comments on TV unlicensed in the NAB filings over the years.
No, I haven't written anything on TV. I haven't gotten any money from the NAB for something like 15 years, and I did nothing on
free
on,
TV, advocating the value of free TV as opposed to
unlicensed. I did nothing on I have done nothing on unlicensed for the broadcasters. I'm pretty confident of that. God knows, I'm getting old and feeble, so I may have completely forgotten, but I try to keep track of who owes me money. No, Qualcomm sells chips to both the license, you know, there are lots, I bet you we got lots of phones, half the phones in this room probably have Qualcomm chips in it. They also own one of the most successful Wi-Fi manufacturing firms. I think they're the only one that's shipping the 60 gigahertz chips yet.
That's probably right.
So they understand both businesses. And if you look at the last piece I did on this for Qualcomm, which, among other things, tried to analyze the market incentives for unlicensed devices in the TV white space, I came to the conclusion that they weren't going to work. And sure enough, 5 years, they've sold, you know, literally dozens. And most of those are developmental projects, not truly market. I don't know if you can go out and buy one yet. But the most telling part was I sent my draft off to Qualcomm for review, and I got back a memo saying, well, when I first started reading Jackson's stuff, I thought he was crazy. I mean, who would want to be trying to do long-distance communications at these frequencies and these powers? It just doesn't make sense. And if you want to do short-range communications, MIMO works better at 2.4 and 5. You get more capacity. So it is true that I formed my understanding of the TV white space market while I was working for Qualcomm. I haven't worked on this issue for the broadcasters. I haven't gotten any money from Qualcomm in years. I'm not doing any work for them now. I haven't had conversations with Qualcomm people probably in a couple of years. I'm telling you what I understand and I've learned by thinking about it. I may be wrong, but it's not whose salt I eat, whose song I sing. This is what I think. And if you want to make a little wager as to the relative market share of TV white space devices and 5 gigahertz devices 10 years from now, I'd probably give you pretty good odds on that bet.
One thing is, I think Chuck's rewriting history quite a lot. Qualcomm only moved into unlicensed, you know, purchasing Atheros, which makes Wi-Fi chips, very recently when, you know, they sort of woke up to the reality of unlicensed. At the time that Jim and Chuck are talking about, Qualcomm owned MediaFlow, which was a service. They were, you know, using TV spectrum over long distances to broadcast video to mobile devices. At least they thought that's what they wanted, and they didn't want any competition. on the TV white space from Unlicensed. So they hired Chuck and many others. And Qualcomm was the most persistent opponent of TV white space at the time. And they had no involvement in Unlicensed at the time, other than MediaFlow, which turned out to be a completely failed business model. And with the and with the white space, there hasn't been many deployments yet because the FCC just got around to certifying the first devices a few months ago. So we're just entering the period of deployment now. And once the uncertainty that's hanging over the ban due to the incentive auctions is cleared up, then we'll actually see how useful it is.
Okay. Any other questions on unlicensed spectrum? Okay, I think we are out of time, but I do want to thank Chuck, Tom, Juanita, and Michael for sharing your perspectives on us, and I'm sure this area will continue to generate a lot of interest. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.